Thank you, Senator Byrd. That's a very interesting question you raise, which is, if we don't adequately fund, do we respond to that by some action which limits liberty or the rights instead of funding? It's an interesting issue, and maybe we can expand on that as we go forward. But initially, the question which I think I'd like to get to is this issue of looking at British successes, what can we do to replicate those successes here without affronting our liberties or our constitutional rights? And Judge Posner, you made it pretty clear that you felt that we could, do we need to do anything legislatively to give the executive branch the right to restrain people or to hold people longer than 48 hours? Do we have to declare that a person who, is there some sort of, should there be some sort of court approval of that event in a FISA's type of situation? Or is that authority basically lie with the executive branch? That's my first question. And the second question is, you suggest that we not bifurcate the FBI, although I have to tell you, I used to chair the committee that had the FBI, and my biggest frustration was that they were not able to move that culture from law enforcement into intelligence. And I still don't think they have, even though I haven't chaired that committee for 2 years. And this was something we put a tremendous amount of pressure on them to do, and they just basically, the culture resisted. But let's assume we aren't going to bifurcate it. Does that mean that an organization like Mr. Negroponte's new intelligence responsibility is sort of the intelligence czar, is the place where you might set up a structure like that would mirror the MI5 effort, and is that appropriate? So those, I'd like to get those thoughts from all three of the witnesses. Well, Mr. Yeo, relative to the whether American law, there is any statutory need in order to get to this British position of being able to hold people for a longer period of time if they're deemed to be terrorists beyond the 48 hours. And then get your thoughts on those.
Okay, let me respond briefly in a reverse order, starting with the question of the FBI and the MI5. Mr. Parker made a very important point. He said that the fact that the MI5, the security service, has a laser beam focus on intelligence is a great value, because the FBI, you mentioned, Senator, that maybe the FBI should be shifting its focus from kidnapping and bank robberies to national security intelligence. Well, the problem is, this happened in Chicago. When the FBI tries to do that, the banks and the people in Chicago, they say, well, wait a second. The number of bank robberies in Chicago is rising because the FBI is allocating resources to intelligence. See, that's the problem. So the FBI is torn. We want it to be the, you know, premier criminal investigation agency. And that's, of course, what they've accustomed to doing, what they're trained to do, what they want to do. So very difficult to change their culture. And you're quite right. 5 years, very little progress has been made in actually altering the focus of the FBI. He also mentioned, Mr. Parker, the fact, of course, MI5 works closely with the special branch of Scotland Yard and of the other British police office. And these special branches are specialized for criminal law enforcement focused on terrorism and espionage and so on. Well, we have the germ of that system here, because the FBI, the president did insist over the FBI's objections that it fuse its terrorist-related units into a new division called the National Security Branch. And it's interesting, he used the same word, branch. That National Security Branch, which is really very similar to the special branch of Scotland Yard, that would work well, I think, with a separate domestic intelligence service. Where to place that service, whether it should be freestanding, whether it should be in the Department of Homeland Security, because as I understand it, MI5 reports to the Home Secretary in United Kingdom, which corresponds to Secretary of Homeland Security. whether it should be freestanding like the CIA and report to the Director of National Intelligence, whether it should actually be in his office. Those are important organization questions which would require further study. In fact, what I'd like to see from Congress, from the Director of National Intelligence, would be, as a first step, a feasibility study. Is this something we need at separate agency? And concretely, how would we establish it? Where would we put it? Would it work? And so on. With regard to your previous question, the first question about detention, Professor Yu reminded me that the Supreme Court has permitted detention of terrorists outside the criminal justice system as enemy combatants. I was thinking more of a system of detention of terrorist suspects, which would not require actually designating them as enemy combatants. And the value of congressional intervention here is that the Supreme Court has left everything very vague. You can hold a person, the government can hold a person for more than 48 hours if it can show that it's a bona fide emergency or there are other exceptional circumstances. I think it would be helpful for Congress to specify what constitutes an emergency, and also to set some limit so that the government officials have some sense how long can they hold a person beyond 48 hours. And we don't want it to be indefinite. And under the English system, as I understand it, and would be a good feature of our system, you don't just make an initial decision, this person is going to be in for 28 days. You have a frequent reauthorization by a judge. And that, I think, and, you know, prescribing the procedures and the timetable for this sort of thing, that would be a function for Congress rather than leaving it to the courts, I would think.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Yeo, did you want to comment on those two issues?
Yes, thanks, Senator. I quite agree with what Judge Posner says on the detention issue. It is a case that the Supreme Court has read the authorization to use military force that you passed on September 18th of 2001 as authorization to detain enemy combatants outside the criminal justice system. But the case of Hamdi, where this was decided, the individual in question was captured outside the United States and in Afghanistan, so it left open the question whether these rules would apply within the United States. And the government detained Jose Padilla under that same claim of authority. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit upheld that as an exercise of this power to detain enemy combatants, but it didn't reach the Supreme Court. And so there is unclarity and ambiguity about whether this power could be used in the future, and so that would be an appropriate area, I agree with, for further congressional explication of the standards. The other difference I would just point out is I take it under the British system, even when you're in this 28-day period, there are regular hearings, there's regular opportunity to go to a judge. In the enemy combatant process, we use the system of habeas corpus, which can take much longer. And then under the Defense Department regulations, there's an annual, I think, review of the combatant status. So the British system actually has more judicial review than ours does on that system. And the one question you might want to ask, and if you are going to go ahead and draft legislation, is whether you want to have more than just annual reviews. This is also tied up in the litigation about, the consideration of how Congress is going to react to the Hamdan bill. There's elements in that bill which talk about civilian judicial review over these determinations and how often they might occur. That's something you could change as that bill goes forward. In terms of the division between MI5, whether to have MI5 type agency or not, I think everyone on the panel seems to agree that the current system is not working, that the FBI's mixture of criminal law enforcement and national security purposes is not a good one. And it's, I don't think it's a question of whether you need to change the statutory authority of the FBI. In a way, what Judge Posner describes, and I quite agree with, is that maybe the statutory focus of the FBI has become too diffuse. They have too many things which they tried to focus on criminal law enforcement, bank robberies. You know, if you look at the history of the FBI, the reason why bank robberies and kidnappings became their initial focus was because they were relatively easy to solve. You had high publicity when you solved them, and it was easy to measure how agents were doing. Right? You could say, I caught 5 bank robbers this month. So it led to this case-based system for promotion within the FBI. And that's an example of how you can't change that kind of culture easily, right? Because it's difficult to count, well, is this manager, this agent doing a good job stopping terrorist attacks? You know, someone can't come and say, I stopped 5 terrorist attacks, because often you don't know how many terrorist attacks.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue here to follow up on that a little bit. We've had a tough time.
I unfortunately have to go to a meeting. Can I turn the hearing over to you?
That would be fine. I didn't realize yet.
I want to thank the witnesses, though, for their time and their courtesy. It's been an extraordinarily informative hearing for me, and hopefully we can take some of the knowledge you've imparted to us and make some good use of it. Thank you very much. And I've got to go to a meeting with the leader here at 11 o'clock, and I will turn it over to Mr. Allard to chair the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I won't take up too much more of the witnesses' time. But you know, the problem we've had here is we've gotten the FBI to talk with the CIA, and they're both government agencies. And I see even greater barriers in getting either one of those agencies to talk to somebody in the private sector.
Yes.
And and it's a confidence issue, I think, you know, that you have very sensitive information, and of course, so the more people know about it, the more apt it's to leak out when you have an open society, particularly like what we have here. And I understand your concerns with these contractors coming in on computer systems and tailoring that computer system just to that department, and they don't worry about interactivity between other departments. I think that is a big problem, not only in the security area, but I think throughout government.
Yes.
And I think it needs to be dealt with, and there is some attempts to do that. We need to do some things, I think, to encourage them to participate with the private sectors. Have you got any thoughts on how we can break down those barriers of confidence? The only way I can think of is maybe if they pick up people who've had previous clearance experience and had worked within the agencies, they go into the private sector, then obviously they've already maybe established some confidence there. But I think it's a tough problem.
Well, one of the problems is that overclassification makes it difficult for the government people to communicate with private people. But especially when we're talking about terrorism, some of the most important information to guide our conflict with the terrorists is knowledge of foreign cultures, foreign languages, foreign history, and so on. And much of that expertise resides in universities and other private sector activities. So we do want to make sure that the government officials can talk to these people, can consult them, can bring them in, and not be impeded by overclassification, by paperwork, by conflict of interest rules that makes it very difficult for private people to consult with the government. I do think the Director of National Intelligence is concerned about that problem and is trying to lower the barriers to intercommunication with the private sector.
I would just say I very much agree with what you say, Senator, about the classification and clearance issue. And part of it's a hangover from the Cold War and a cultural problem, because a lot of the rules on clearances and so on were built up to prevent the Soviet Union from getting an agent inside and learning information. That doesn't seem to be the challenge that we face with Al-Qaeda. We don't, as far as I know, have examples of Al-Qaeda agents infiltrating into the United States government. So I think this would be an appropriate area for the Appropriations Committee to consider, is whether it wants to change the way clearances are given, how many people are permitted to have them. This isn't just cause problems for interoperability between federal agencies. It's a major barrier for interoperability between the federal agencies and state and local law enforcement. That's, I think, where you even see more resistance to the sharing, not just between the FBI and the CIA, but then down to the people who actually have to make the tough decisions. So that, you know, and this is also an area where computers could provide help. I mean, corporations and universities, other entities, have all used technology to control the flow of information in different ways using commercially available products. And I've always wondered why we don't, it doesn't seem like we have a chief information officer in the federal government. There's certain kinds of innovations that technology can use, which the private sector is way ahead in, which I think could be rather easily adapted to face some of those problems you've raised. But we don't have anyone in the government who's looking at the use of information technology centrally. Each agency has their own CIO, but we don't have one for the government as a whole, it seems. And that might be an area the Appropriations Committee might call for that kind of work to be done by the executive branch, and it would be very helpful, I think.
If I could offer a personal observation, I'm not sure it's quite as bad as you fear. I spent 6 months in Baghdad in 2003 as the British Special Advisor on Transitional Justice. And I was struck, actually, at how closely the other government agencies work with contractors, how heavily involved they were in all aspects of operations in the field. I was there essentially as a private sector contractor for the Foreign Office. Within a month and a half, I sat on the high-value detainee video conferencing, telephone conferencing system with the CIA and Defense Intelligence Agency. I was amazed. I mean, absolutely amazed that they would allow me in the room. And in fact, we had very useful, very fruitful discussions. So I think, again, successful collaboration tends to breed relationships of trust. And perhaps one of the good things that does come out of Iraq is that there's a much, much greater awareness now of the value sometimes of these sort of contractor relationships and the skills that are out there in the private sector and how that can be utilized by the intelligence agencies. So maybe there's a ray of hope, perhaps, already there.
I'm going to change the subject a little bit, but it's very pertinent to the debate going on in the Congress as we sit here. And you brought up the issue of detainees. And one of the debates that we're having is because of our Constitution and the way we protect the rights of the accused, they have to face their accuser, and they have to be informed of those facts in a civilian court. And with the recent Supreme Court decision, which has now extended certain rights to detainees, we have a problem if we disclose all that information that we know about the accused in a court case, we make it public, or potentially public. And this creates a problem on security issues where we don't necessarily want them to know how we got the information or who the informer is and those kind of things. How do other countries deal with that issue? Or are we just unique in that because of the protections we provide to the accused? And I wondered maybe you could comment on that, Mr. Parker, and any of you that on the panel that may be familiar with how and how maybe suggestions on how we can deal with that.
Well, disclosure became an issue in British law in the early 1990s, and it took a while for the intelligence services to adapt to that. The first case, in fact, was an animal rights case, I believe in Reading and just west of London, where the police were forced to drop the case because the judge ruled in the interest of disclosure the identity of the informant had to be revealed, and the police simply dropped the case at that point. We've moved a long way from that. There's an instrument in British law called a public interest immunity certificate where agencies who want to protect intelligence can apply to a judge to have it excluded from the rules of disclosure. The judge gets to read it. He gets to make his own judgment about the sensitivity of the document. And if he feels that the government puts together a reasonable case, he will issue a public interest, a PII certificate. So that's the mechanism that we use in the United Kingdom. Also, the other thing we've done is reverse engineer cases so that if, for example, technical capabilities might be exposed in the course of a trial, we might use obsolete equipment for that particular case, in a listening device or some sort of beacon device. We might deliberately use equipment for that case, simply hoping that it will get disclosed to the court. The IRA used to send intelligence officers to every trial. They would sit there, they would write down, they would do lessons learned on every single case that came before the court. One of the biggest intelligence successes we had in the early 1990s was this debate about whether or not digital phones could be intercepted, digital cell phones could be intercepted. There was a what is essentially an urban myth that analog cell phones could be intercepted and digital phones couldn't be. And for a 3 or 4 year period, a lot of people used digital cell phones when they were perfectly easy to intercept and talk quite openly on it. Well, that was clearly a capability that we had no wish in revealing in court. Yeah. In this particular instance, of course, we are, I think, the only country in the world where telephone intercept material is not admissible as evidence, period. So that issue doesn't come up specifically. But sharing intelligence, identity of sources, technical capabilities are serious issues. And we've typically tried to protect our techniques by going for these public interest immunity certificates.
Okay, if we don't have any other comments on the question, I don't have any more questions. I want to thank the panel for your participation and your comments. And I want to check with the staff and see if there's anything here on closing the committee we need to mention. 10-day comment period or anything like that. Really. Okay. Then I'm going to declare the committee adjourned.